The good life is one inspired by love and guided by knowledge. You'll find both love and knowledge here on The Misdiagnosed Life. Here is your host, Beverly Butler.
According to the National Eye Institute, as much as 20% or more of the general population and up to 85% of the special education population have this condition, and most don't know it. It takes a specialized doctor to diagnose it, and it has been stated that 8 out of 10 juvenile delinquents have this problem. It can cause symptoms of ADD, ADHD, dyslexia, or other learning disorders. Children with this condition have difficulty in school and oftentimes have behavioral problems associated with it. So what is this problem that can cause so much pain and disharmony in life? Well, it's an eye disorder, and only a specially trained optometrist called a behavioral or developmental optometrist can diagnose it. It's in the field of ophthalmology called orthoptics, and it takes a special type of vision therapy to correct it. I have with me Dr. Sharon Snyder, who is such an optometrist that specializes in diagnosing and treating this type of vision problem. That's what we're going to be talking about today on the show. I'm so glad to have you on the show today. And I wanted to ask you, you know, I mentioned there was this, the statistics show there's as much as 20%, some people think a little more, of the population has this eye disorder. That's a big percentage. Do you really think it's that much of the population?
I think that's probably a conservative estimate, really.
Wow. Well, tell us exactly what this disorder is. I mean, is it actually with the eyes, or is it actually a brain problem, or what is this eye disorder?
Well, basically, your visual system is your dominant sensory system. And as a sensory system, that is a brain system. So when we're talking about vision, we're talking about everything that's involved with vision. So when we're talking about eye disorders, of the category we're talking about, I consider them to be kind of learning-related visual disorders. So they can be anything from a lazy eye, where you have vision in one eye that just doesn't correct to 20/20, and that can be due to something as simple as maybe needing glasses, where the prescription's different between the two eyes. But generally, it's more involved than that. But it's one eye has become lazy, for either refractive error problems or because an eye turn is developed. So that's called strabismus. But the more common type of visual disorders that we see and deal with are what we'd call non-strabismic binocular vision disorders. And a non-strabismic disorder, it includes things where the eyes have a tendency to drift. And so during a routine eye exam, the child may be able to see 20/20 and everything looks normal, but when you put them in a visual stress-inducing situation like school and they're trying to read a book, their eyes may actually drift in, or they may drift out, or they may have a hard time literally changing their focus from the board to the book. There's other conditions where the eyes have a hard time tracking from one target to another. So there's a whole slew of visual problems in this category that we're trying to discuss this morning.
Okay. Now, a normal, you could take your child to an ophthalmologist or just a what I'd call a regular optometrist. They don't typically catch these things, do they?
No, they do not. Generally, the goal of a routine eye exam, whether it's ophthalmology or optometry, is to check the health and the structure of the eye. And so what we're talking about today is more the function of the eye. So if I used a computer analogy, it'd be the difference of the checking the hardware of a computer versus the software of a computer system.
Okay. So you're basically checking the software?
The software. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you have to have a lot of extra training to do this, don't you? I mean, you have several certifications, and I'll tell us a little bit about the extra training that an optometrist has to have to do this.
Okay. Whenever a doctor goes through and receives their doctorate degree, you know, that is a four-year program just for the optometry degree. But our 4 years in optometry, it is spent basically on being able to diagnose and treat health conditions of the eye. And there'll be a few little courses, but nothing like what we're going to be talking about this morning. So after receiving the doctorate degree, what I've done is I've gone ahead and have had other courses in the specific fields of binocular vision. So I had to take a board certificate course with the the College of Optometrists and Vision Development, and that's the international board that governs the field that I'm in. I've also taken a lot of other courses over the years in different aspects of brain function and phototherapy and brainwave entrainment, and currently taking a course on QEEG, and just continuing to try to take new courses to help us to help our patients a lot better.
Yeah, the learning never stops, does it?
It does not. It's fun. I'm glad it doesn't stop.
Yeah, well, I know you love learning, and that's one thing I like about you. Plus, you're just an excellent doctor. You were treating our daughter, and I thought did just a fantastic job. Well, we're coming up on a break. When we come back, I want to talk more about the sensory problems and how that kind of connects with the other sensory systems. So we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Now, you had mentioned, Dr. Snyder, you had mentioned that the eyes, of course, are one of our major sensory organs, and you seem to indicate that this is more of a sensory problem with the brain, because the brain controls all that. Of course, the brain's the main control center anyway. You also deal, and this was one of my questions a little later on, but we'll go ahead and get to it. You also deal with sensory processing disorder. That's what it's called. And first of all, tell us what that is, because I know you also, like I said, you treat that at your clinic. And what is the connection between, and you know, how does all this fit in with the eye problems, the brain, and then the sensory processing disorder problems? And I see several children have that. Usually it's the more sensitive children. Of course, that makes sense. And and I know adults can have it too, but I'm really seeing it a lot in the 20-somethings and younger.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So explain what sensory processing disorder is, and how you treat it, and what you think causes it.
Okay. Well, you know, it's really going to depend on which healthcare profession that you talk to as far as what definition they will give you for sensory processing disorder. Based on our bias coming from the visual care field, the definition that I feel is the best would be that sensory processing involves the brain being able to integrate all the information come from its various senses. So in the fifth grade is when a lot of children learn about the sense of seeing and hearing and taste and smell and touch. And actually, there are a lot more senses that have been discovered as far as in all the neurological research. But in what we're dealing with in our practice, we've learned that vision and vestibular and auditory are three very dominant senses that if they do not function well together, a person is going to have problems with their ability to process information from a sensory standpoint.
Okay, now the vestibular system, that explain what that is. Some people will not know what that is.
Okay, in the inner ear, you have the two systems side by side, and one of them is for hearing, that's your auditory system, but your vestibular system is right there beside it, and that is your system for balance. It basically lets the brain know the position of the head in space. So it lets the brain know if you are sitting up or if you're laying down or if you're tumbling or just where the head is in relation to the body in space. And what's so important about the vestibular system, it is the first sensory system to develop while the baby's in utero.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
So it's a system, it operates 24/7. So while before that baby's even born, it lets the baby know if mom's bending over doing laundry or finally getting to take a nap or dashing out the door checking the older child. So it provides a lot of information for that developing brain.
Okay. So it's really the problems are still originating in the brain. And it's not, somehow the message is not getting to the vestibular system and the auditory. Is that the way it works?
Well, from what our knowledge so far seems to indicate, and if you ever looked at a diagram of what they know about brain paths right now, it's mind-boggling. But a simplified way that helps me to think of it is since we have zeroed in mostly on the visual and auditory and vestibular, those three sensory systems, actually the nerve fiber bundles, they come together in the area of the brain called the midbrain. And so that's why we have chosen to emphasize that in our therapy, trying to get those systems to work. There is a principle that says that, I think it's called the Hebbian principle, and it says nerves that fire together, wire together. And so our goal is to help the brain to be able to stimulate the brain in such a way that those three systems are having to fire together. They're having to process information simultaneously. And then the brain has to do something about that and has to rewire so it can cope with and handle all that information simultaneously.
Okay. So it's the communication part of the brain.
That's a good part of it.
That's a big part. Okay. Because I know my daughter had a lot of vestibular problems, and it was kind of funny when we were backing out of the driveway one day, and she says, "Mom, I'm getting car sick." And I'm like, "Well, honey, we haven't gone anywhere yet." And so it can really get off the vestibular system along with all these other problems. And she had a lazy eye also, and I wanted to ask, if in every case, if a person has a lazy eye, does that automatically mean they have these problems, or can you have a lazy eye and it's just a muscle thing and they really don't have this brain problem?
You know, a lot of times a true lazy eye, if that's all a person has, that can actually be something that's very easily, a person can cope with that real easily. So if it's simply a lazy eye, basically what that means is the brain has turned one eye off for a couple of major reasons generally, and it's just coping with using one eye. And sometimes that's easy. I mean, the brain only has to deal with the function of one eye, and that's fine.
Okay.
But if a child has that, plus they also have a tactile sensitivity where every tag has to be cut out of their clothes for them to survive, or their sock seams have to be on a certain way, then that adds another level of complexity to it.
Right. Yeah, I know that. And that's some of the symptoms of the sensory processing disorder. Now, I know you can have it either way, where they need more stimulation to their skin. And sometimes they actually on purpose run into walls or fall down because they need that extra stimulation. But I think a lot of times, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like most of the time it's very sensitive, because I don't know how many tags I had to cut out and turn socks inside out and trim socks. I've even cut holes in socks trying to trim the seam, because any little thing, she was so sensitive to clothes and things. So this is also a big symptom of that can indicate they could have some of these or do have some of these problems. And especially, so you're saying especially if they have, it's not always if they have a lazy eye, but if they have a lazy eye in connection with these other sensory issues, then you're saying it would probably be a good idea for them to be checked out by a developmental optometrist?
Right. Correct.
Because these can cause problems that can be easily avoided if the problems are caught in time and they get the correct therapy to fix these.
Correct.
Okay. What do you think causes this problem that the brain is not actually, communicating and functioning correctly, or not processing the information correctly coming in through the senses? What do you think causes that? Does it start from birth?
Well, I would think it possibly starts before birth.
Right.
A lot of it, I think, has to do with the health of the mother's intestinal system. They're learning a lot that the gut is actually the second brain. They know, and you've probably discussed this on previous podcasts.
Yes, I have.
Okay, so we know that the gut is the second brain. And so if the mother has a stomach that is less than optimal, then when she gives birth to her baby, then this baby's going to inherit that same gut system. And so then if on top of that, if we have a child that has a compromised intestinal system, if they happen to have vaccinations, and then that vaccination with the toxin in it, it can cause an immune response. And so I really strongly suspect that vaccines are a part in some of these. There are other things too. There's environment, our water is contaminated. The typical diet that we're eating is not a good diet. I think probably the average American, 95% of the food they eat is processed food. Well, that is not real nutrition for a child's developing brain. So it just depends. A lot of it has to do, like I said, it starts before birth and it continues on with what we put in our body, whether it's by vaccinations or drugs or food. And I think food's a big issue for a lot of families.
Yes, I do too. So you're basically saying that, it's amazing how many things go back to the gut. I mean, so many health issues just go back to the gut. Mm-hmm. And you're right. They have come up. Some of the latest research is showing that the gut is the second brain. So you're basically saying that that a mother with an unhealthy gut that gives birth, and I know there's a difference. Actually, babies that are vaginally born are a lot healthier than in ways than C-section babies, because they get the probiotics from the mother when they're born, and that kind of thing. So that's important. But so you're saying that it starts in utero, and then if the mother has an unhealthy gut, she's basically setting her child up to be extra vulnerable. And some of these other things like vaccines, toxins in the water, toxins in food, et cetera, just add to the load that the body is trying to bear, and they can get to some point that the body can't take it anymore, and then they start having some real problems sometimes. Mm-hmm. That's what you're seeing in your practice?
Yes, yes. Because when we first started, we started in, I graduated in 83 and really did not go into the first aspect of what we do now, the vision therapy, until about 92. And from 92 to the end of the 90s, most of our cases were fairly simple. You know, they'd be what I call an uncomplicated visual skills case. But late 90s, you know, into the 2000s, we have seen a change in our patients. And it is very, very rare for us to get one of those simple cases now. And some of the things that changed is in the 90s was the vaccination schedule was radically changed. I suspect Roundup in our food has become a big issue for a lot of the developing neurological systems.
I do
and
too.
So nowadays, when I see a child, we tend to see a lot of sensory issues. You know, we'll see tactile and auditory and olfactory. You know, I'll have some children come in here and they just have to sniff everything before I can do the next aspect of the exam. So all those are brain functioning issues that we're seeing that's been impacted since the 90s.
Yeah, and so you're saying that one of the causes of it really is our toxins.
It is. It's our toxic environment.
Yeah, that's what I suspected too. And when I have talked to other people, and I know I have on this podcast, so you're that are seeing patients and their customers and patients getting sicker and sicker, and so it sounds like you are too, and that's very scary.
Mm-hmm. It is. When we started back in the 90s, autism was 1 out of 10,000, and I think the new rate is now 1 out of 5.
Wow. Yeah, it's something like that. It's mm-hmm. it's outrageous.
It is.
And the predictions, if things don't change, it's just going to get worse.
It is.
And that's very scary. So we've got to wake up and figure out what's causing this and turn it around. Okay, so how do you diagnose this problem? Just give us kind of a brief overview. I know that when we went to you, you really put my daughter through the mill. You did all kinds of testing I've never seen before, and I was really impressed with it. So briefly go over kind of how you diagnose it and the tests that you use.
Okay. When a patient comes into our office, they have generally already had their routine eye exam. And because, you know, the routine eye exam determines whether the eyes are healthy and checks whether the child needs glasses. So this is the point that we normally see a child and or an adult, as the case may be. But the person comes in and in our test, and we divided it into two parts. The part one, we call it the neuromotor testing, and that is where we go ahead and I'll recheck the refraction. My goal is to try to balance the prescription between the two eyes as best I can. But then we'll do a series of tests to check how well the eyes actually team together, and that's binocular vision. We'll also do tests on how well the eyes can focus. And I'm focusing, it's, you know, so many times in the school system, you think of just being able to maintain attention. And when we're talking about it from a visual function standpoint, we're literally meaning, can the eyes make the target come into focus, whether that target is at distance or if it's up close. We'll also have focusing facility tests to see how quickly they can shift their focus from a distance to near to a distance target in a minute's time. We're doing a tracking test to see how quickly the eyes can move from one target to the next, how accurately, you know, what level do they score? Is it age appropriate? Is it grade level appropriate? Then from there, after we've done all those tests, those are the neuromotor tests, then we'll move into the brain-based portion of it. Even though neuromotor is brain-based, we'll call the other brain-based, but it's the processing. So we'll do visual processing tests. We've also learned to do auditory processing tests because if the visual system's impacted, there's a significant number of our students that their auditory system will also be impacted. Even if they have perfect hearing, kind of like eyesight. They can have perfect hearing, but they don't function. They don't process their hearing well.
And that includes, because I know my daughter had the auditory issues also, and I noticed certain sounds would mm-hmm. bother her, but others wouldn't. In other words, she could go to a ball game of 90,000 people and be okay, but you know, if I run the vacuum cleaner, that like drove her crazy. So right. So this is kindly what you're talking about on the auditory mm-hmm. system. Certain sounds bother them, and others don't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're looking to see which ear is dominant. The right ear should be dominant, and if the left ear is dominant, even over part of the range of hearing, then that can cause some behavioral responses. I'll have children that come in and they can't stand the, I'll ask them, said, does the sound of your parents chewing bother you? Oh, yes, I can't stand the sound when the fork hits their teeth. And mother and dad are sitting over there like, what? You've never told us. Or that explains why you always go to the other room to eat. And it can be subtle things like that. But like you said, they can go to a football game and nothing fazes them. Or they go to a loud church service and they may have problems with the music, sit there with their ears covered. But then at home, they're noise generators. So, right. You know, it depends on how their particular auditory system is wired and how it's responding to different frequencies of sound.
Yeah, and the thing about it is these are they're so unique. And after you finish talking about the you know the test and how you diagnose it, I want to talk more about the symptoms because okay. these children do not know that that's not normal.
Right.
And the parents don't know to look for to notice these things. They just wonder why the child's acting so weird or why they get up and leave or why certain they don't understand. And that's mm-hmm. one thing I wanted to really get this information out because, you know, and I know sometimes that words can move on a page. Well, mm-hmm. the child, a 5-year-old don't know that that's not normal and they can be be having trouble in school. But go ahead and finish talking about your test.
Okay. Well, after we do the auditory processing test, we'll also do a test for brain timing. And brain timing, we've learned actually, and our different professionals use that indicator in different ways. What we use it for, that helps us with knowing how distractible a child will be and also how easy it is for them to make what we call a planned motor response, like, say, handwriting, for example, or throwing a ball accurately. We'll also have a test that's called a visograph, and the visograph, some school systems have used it, but it's not widely used as it should be. It's where you have a set of goggles, and the goggles have infrared sensors on the inside, and they actually record where the eyes are looking on a piece of paper as a child's reading. So it gives us information as far as grade level efficiency and words per minute the child's actually reading and how many times the child loses fixation or has to look back when they're reading. So it gives us a lot of information there. We've also do something called a functional field test. And that one is where we actually see how big a piece of the visual field that a child's actually able to process at a time. And a lot of children, from a structural standpoint, their structural visual fields are normal. They're wide open. But when it comes to function, you know, any type of stress will cause their visual field to tunnel down. And we'll have children come in here, and their visual field might be the size of a paper towel tube or a straw. You know, some of them are just really severe. It's just very, very small. And so these children have such a small field that they can actively use that you might send them in the room and say, well, go get your shoes and grab your sweater on the chair and come on back. And they spend 20 minutes in the room and can never find it. And then you walk in and say, well, it's right there. Can't you see it?
Yeah, it's because they're looking through a tunnel. They have no peripheral vision.
Right. And so it happens that during a routine test, these children would have tested 20/20, you know, on an eye chart. But when it comes to a functioning situation, you know, it just totally tunnels down. And so they don't do well.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's really so interesting. And it's just, this is so unknown to parents and children alike.
It's unknown to doctors too, because we didn't discover it ourselves until 2005, I guess. So here I had graduated in 83, and I would hear just a few doctors here and there talk about this particular field. And I thought, you know, what is that? It just sounded really odd. And so we finally attended a course, I think it was about 2005, and it was just literally eye-opening, no pun intended.
Yeah.
But it explained some of the issues that we were still having with some of our patients. So, and it's something that we've learned how to open those functioning fields up because it's an indicator of the autonomic nervous system function. So it's been that's been probably one of the biggest things that has helped our patients, is having that functioning field size enlarged.
Wow, that's fantastic. And, you know, it just all goes to show you don't know what you don't know. That's one of my favorite quotes.
Correct. I want to know what I don't know now.
Yeah, I know. And it kindly makes you wonder, well, what else is going on we don't know about? You know, and it's amazing. The more I do a lot of research and study, and the more, and I know you do too, and the more we learn, it's like, what else is there? I mean, you know, we're not near as smart as we think we are. So let's go over some of the symptoms. Okay. There's several parents out there, and I know we're going to be talking to a good many people that they or their children have this problem. List several of the symptoms that go with these problems.
Okay. Well, as you said, you made a comment about the child when the words move on the page, they don't realize that's not normal. And that is so true. They grow up and they think, well, everybody sees things like this happen. So some of the symptoms that you might see is and many times you actually have to ask the child this because the parent doesn't know either. But if you have a child who complains that their eyes burn or feel strained after they've read just a little bit, that generally indicates something's going on visually. If their vision gets blurry when reading, if they get headaches or stomach aches when they read, if the letters or words run together or move when reading, some children will actually report seeing double, but generally you have to ask them, do you ever see double when you read? Because they think everybody does, so why bring it up? If a child fatigues real quickly when reading or gets belligerent, you know, with reading, or wants to start bartering, you read a page and I'll read a page, that's generally an indicator there's something going on with their neuromotor stamina. If their reading comprehension decreases with time, if they often lose their place or omit words when reading, some children just avoid reading. You know, they're not interested in it at all, and they avoid it successfully. Other children may skip words or lines or have to reread lines. Or occasionally you'll have a child that when you're sitting with them and you're trying to listen to them read and the book is constantly moving, they're pulling it closer and pushing it away and turning it on their side. And what they're doing is they're trying to get that book in a position where it's either in focus or their eyes are comfortable. Sometimes it can be more obvious if you have, generally grandmothers are very good with this. If they tell you that your child's eyes don't look right, you need to listen to grandmother because she knows. But sometimes the eyes might appear to cross, and you can have the obvious. Strabismus is a condition where the eye just absolutely, you can tell it's either turned in or turned out. But some of these non-strabismic binocular problems we're talking about, and those, the eyes just may drift just a little bit. And sometimes it's noticeable, but most of the time it's not. I'll have other children, I'll put a book in front of their eyes and immediately their eyes turn red or water, or sometimes their whole face will flush. A lot of these children are very frustrated. We have what we call the homework wars. And a homework war for us is when 20 minutes worth of homework should take maybe, 20 minutes worth of homework might take a person 3 hours or so to complete. And by the end of it, mom and the child may both be crying. So, there's a lot of tension that's associated with this.
And it also affects their behavior. So tell some of the behavioral problems you see and parents see in these children.
Right.
And why that happens.
You know, it's the child is under a lot of stress. And there's a visual stressor. There may be some other stressors that are going on. But it can be just basically that their brain function, they're struggling so hard to make sense of what they're doing. We'll have some children that if they're reading, they can't listen to you at the same time. So if they're in a classroom, the teacher is teaching, but they're trying to read, they can only use one system, so they turn the other one off. Or we'll have some children when they're trying to listen to the teacher talk to them, they won't engage. There's no eye contact, so they're looking down, and the teacher or parent may think the child's rude, but that's the only way the child can actually comprehend what's being said. Because if they're looking at you, they can't process vision and hearing at the same time.
Right. They can't multitask. And I know that's one thing you help work with them so they can multitask.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I know my daughter said when she was younger, I'm a type A personality and I'm like just boom, 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 you know, and I may tell her, I've told her two or three things to do at once. And one time she was probably seven or so. One time she said, Mama, just tell me one thing to do at a time, you know, because it was too much. It was too much. And that can also lead to some, school problems other than the obvious. I know sometimes my daughter, if it was too much, like if children would be talking, the teacher would be talking, and of course she had some OCD, so a lot was going on in her mind anyway, and she would just tune out because it was just too much, and she would just look out the window. And sometimes teachers, you know, they think they're not listening, or they, you know, and they may get, you know, the child may get in trouble. And I think this is something, and it's just because the child is overwhelmed and they can't process everything. So I think this is really good for teachers to listen to. And teachers need to be trained to look for certain signs in these children and see if maybe there's something else going on, especially if they're generally a good child anyway. But then again, you can have children that just misbehave a lot because, like I said earlier, the, some of the statistics are showing 8 out of 10 juvenile delinquents have this problem. And to me, that's very sad because, you know, I wonder, you know, and no doubt there's more going on with that, but what if, you know, they got the right vision therapy and the right treatment, maybe they wouldn't be in juvenile, you know, a juvenile delinquent. So I'm really glad we're bringing this out. And you also mentioned that you see ADD and ADHD and other some improvement with autistic kids, children. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, a lot of times when you have a child that trying to do any type of a visual task is very difficult for them, then they do not want to do those tasks. So in a classroom, a lot of these children are mislabeled ADD. And it's because they would rather look out the room or they want to see what the child across the aisle is doing instead, because it's a lot easier and more pleasant for them than trying to sit there looking at these words that are moving on the page or having to deal with the headache or the stomach ache that just started when they're trying to read. So we see a lot of children that are mislabeled ADD. There are children that are ADHD, and I think many of those have a large vision component. But in those, I think there's also this other toxic issue we discussed earlier. And if that child had the wrong breakfast that morning, or they had a blueberry, you know, a blue slushy or something else, you know, we'll have children come in here and they're just all hyped up from the donuts that they just got or the dye in their drink or just an improper breakfast. That's going to impact behavior also as far as their hyperactivity level. If you have a child who has painful hearing, they may be sitting in the classroom if they can hear what the teacher's talking, you know, the across the hall or next door, and that's very distracting for them. Or their classmates that are sitting there, you may have a classmate that just kind of likes to drum their pencil on the table. Everybody else is ignoring it, but for the child that has an auditory processing problem, they're in pain, they're in agony. And so it just depends on how that child processes their world and how they take that information in. And in a healthy environment, you process it very easily with no second thought. But in an environment where you have sensory processing issues, every, you know, any little thing can be like a burr in the saddle. You know, it can be very distracting, very uncomfortable, very painful for these children.
Yeah. And these children also, a good number of these children also have anger issues.
Definitely.
I mean, it makes them angry, which I can, you could see and understand why they would be if they're if simple things hurt, you know, hurt their hear, you know, hurt their ears, or are very uncomfortable for them.
So
that might be also one thing you may want to take a look at if your child is maybe exhibiting some of these symptoms, but they have just a lot of anger. You know, so okay. So how do you treat it?
You know, in our practice, we have gradually grown as far as what we've done. When we first started out, we started out with vision therapy. But in doing the testing, if we find out a child has a lot of sensory processing problems in addition to the visual problem, we actually start out one of two ways. We'll either start out with a program called the Sensory Learning Program, and it originated by a woman out in Colorado named Mary Bowles. And that is a protocol where a child lays on a treatment table. And the treatment table is providing vestibular stimulation. At the same time, they have auditory processing headphones on, so they're receiving auditory processing therapy. And they're viewing a visual a phototherapy unit that's suspended above their face. So the brain is having to take in all this information simultaneously. And so that's generally the route that we start if I have a child that it's a complicated case.
Yeah, and I know my daughter did that. You may have actually improved even since we've been there. But you said this is, I think you told us back then, this was to help her multitask. This is to help her to, you know, the child to be able to do several things at once.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Go ahead.
So we utilize that. Now, some children don't have the auditory issues. If they have just the functioning field size issues, we may start that child off just with phototherapy to go ahead and get the field size functioning at an appropriate level. So if that foundation is needed, we'll do that. And then if the child has vision issues, then we'll move into the phase of treatment for the vision therapy where we're dealing with if it's a lazy eye or if we have the print move on the page or, you know, eye teaming or focusing or tracking problems. So this is generally the phase we deal with that. And that's the phase that lasts the longest. I'd say typically in our practice, the typical case is about 6 to 7 months. We'll have some very simple cases that are through in 4 months. We have some protracted cases like strabismus, you know, the eye turns. They may be a year or more. But a typical case is 6 to 7 months on the vision therapy. As we're going through, we will retest the functioning field size because we're trying to get it up to an optimal range. And sometimes another round of phototherapy is indicated to help adjust that. And then when we're through with this phase of therapy, we will also we'll retest the auditory and see if that's still an issue. Some children, if the visual system is corrected, the auditory self-corrects and we don't have to deal with it. But we'll have a few that still need some additional auditory processing therapy. So that's what we're doing in the office. We have learned also, though, is that nutrition is very important. So we work with a naturopathic practitioner and try to provide information for these parents so they can know what to do there to support the child from a biochemical, you know, an actual physical level. About 3 years ago, we discovered a field of chiropractic that's called Atlas Orthogonal. And their website is www.globalao.com. And that has been a very much of a benefit to our patients also. It turns out that a lot of our children will have had falls very easy. You know, as a baby, they may roll off the bed or crash their bicycle into the wall or something like that. Well, if that top vertebrae gets dislocated even a little bit, it's going to affect the way the head sits on the spinal column. That affects blood flow to the head. That'll affect nervous impulses from the brain to the gut. So we have learned to make referrals for that in many of our cases too, and that's been a big blessing to a lot of our patients.
Yeah, and I have heard of that, and I've heard of people going and having that done, and they have had really good results. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Okay, well, after they go through the treatment, does the results usually stay? I mean, does it stay fixed once treatment's over, or do the problems come back, or do they have to have a tune-up every now and then? How does that work?
Okay, when we first started in this field, we did not realize that you have to monitor afterwards. So what we will do is now what we've learned to do is when a child has gone through therapy, we will have them come back several times over the first year. Normally, typically it's 3 times over that first year. And during that year, what I have them do is they continue their vision activities that they were dispensed as they went through therapy. But during the next year, we call it maintenance. And maintenance is where they're continuing to practice their new visual skills. But I gradually wean them off of the procedures. So most children, when they get a year out of finishing their vision therapy phase, they're pulling up maybe one procedure once a week and making sure their eyes can still do it. And then I'll ask those individuals just to probe once a month and just make sure that they can continue to do the visual activities. That way, if they happen to have a problem, it's very quick for us to pick up, and then they can come back in and we can do some tune-up procedures. Generally, we have found that most people will maintain the results that they have. The things that will undo it will be things like concussions, you know, so sports injuries, high fevers, you know, any type of medication reactions. So if a person has anything like that, they're instructed to come back in so we can deal with it real quickly. But the long-term usage of it has been very, very good, as long as we make sure we do the maintenance phase afterwards. When we first started, we didn't know that. So the first few years, we would just do therapy and say, you're corrected, and that was fine for about 2 years, and they would gradually regress. So adding the maintenance has helped prevent that.
Okay. Now, I know we've talked about symptoms, but I want to get a little more specific. And what should parents look for? If I think every parent needs to kindly check this and look for certain things just to be sure, because since the percentage is so high that so many people have these, what are some of the things parents should look for just to see if maybe their child might need to go to be checked for these problems?
You know, I used to, I would say, would just compare yours to another child, you know, as far as developmental delays, but you can't do that since so many children now are all walking the same path. But some of the areas you could consider dividing into categories. So if the child's already in school, you're looking at academic skills, how do they seem to be functioning there? You know, if school is not pleasurable for them, it should be, because most children really love school. If they're functioning well and their eyesight's good and their auditory is good and the sock seams aren't bothering them, then they are going to enjoy school. So if they don't, that's normally an indication of problems. Is there a speech delay? Is speech now appropriate for their age? Do they speak clearly? You know, those are indications. If they have a hard time understanding others, that could be an indication of problems. We've discussed the behavior aspect of it, and you're looking at behavior, especially if you're in a what we call a sensory-rich environment. You know, if they're going to areas in, for example, if you take them to Walmart, the bathroom, and you flush the toilet, and that auto-flush toilet sends them into meltdown mode, that's an indication there's a sensory problem. You know, if they don't like vacuum cleaners and hair dryers, that's an indication there's something going on from an auditory standpoint. You know, if they toe walk or if they hand flapped, those can be indications kind of pre-autistic spectrum issues. On the other hand, you can have some that are hyper-stimulated, but then you may have other children that are just under-stimulated. You think this would really rev them up, and it doesn't. We'll have children that have very high pain thresholds. I had one child once that her parents reported that she had stumbled into the midst of a fire ant bed and had never noticed as these fire ants were just eating her up.
Wow.
So we'll see, and so that's fairly dramatic, but we'll have others, they'll fall and hit their head. They don't do anything more than just get up and dust themselves off, but it lets you know that their pain thresholds aren't normal. Others will obsess with just routines. You know, they have to do repetitive behaviors. You know, a child may have to have all their toys lined up in a straight row, or their room is set up in military order. And now we have children on the other end of the spectrum, too, that, you know, their room is chaotic. But we'll see just certain types of routines that a child may go into that clearly is not considered normal. But you think, oh, that's cute. You know, that's so sweet, or that's quirky. You know, in our situation, I had a child that from the time as a baby, he wanted to be with me. So he would go to my Sunday school class. He did not want to go to his own Sunday school class. He sat there. He was grown up. You know, he was not a disruptor. And in hindsight, I'm realizing that that was a sensory issue. You know, we have found out later on that it was because he couldn't process being in that other environment. So he was willing to make the sacrifice to sit quietly with us. So some things that we think are just great, maybe they're not. If it's not age appropriate or not normal, you know, there may be some things going on.
Yeah.
You know, other things too, just wanted to mention, if parents can avoid surgeries before that child is five, if they can put most surgeries off until after 5 years of age, you know, they're learning that a lot of these anesthetics put the child to sleep actually are neurotoxic. And, you know, some of the things that tonsils taken out or tubes put in, and sometimes it's presented as a medical emergency, but if it's not, it's better to put that off until at least after age five, because I think that's impacting the brain development of a lot of our young children.
Wow, that's good. I'm glad you mentioned that. And also sports. Mention sports, because I know with the tracking, and I wanted to bring this up, the tracking problems with the eyes, that just basically means they have trouble following the, you know, the ball from the pitcher to the bat, or, you know, following things. And sometimes these children can be, and sometimes they can get worse. They can be really good at sports, and then they take a turn, and then they're not very good in sports. And that could, or sometimes they're not ever good in sports, but that could be an eye problem causing that. So that could be another thing they could look at. It's not, you know, always the case, but it could be one thing, because I know tracking problems is, that's a reason or a cause of tracking the problems, you know, the problems with the eyes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I agree with you on that. When it comes to sports, there are several things. Tracking is one issue, and there are two types of tracking movements. One is called saccades, or if I was an ophthalmologist, I'd call it saccades. But with that, that's the ability to jump the eyes from one target to another. So that's used more in reading when you're going letter to letter to letter, or word to word to word, or line to line to line. In sports, we're using a type of tracking motion called a pursuit. And pursuits are when you're following the flight of a ball coming towards you or falling or going across the field. And so you've got these different types of eye tracking skills. And if they haven't developed to where they're on par for what they need to be for that particular age and sport, then a child's going to have a hard time. If a child has problems with balance, that will also impact their sports ability. If a child has a reduced functioning field size where it's tunneled down to the size of a, you know, like a straw, they're not going to follow that ball flying rapidly towards their face. And so after they get hit a time or two, you know, they're not going to be so gung-ho to go out and play baseball or softball.
Right, and they shouldn't. Right. They can't see.
I agree. But yeah. So many times you'll have a dad that's a coach, you know, and then his child is functioning and it just hates it, you know, he does not have any interest in it. And from a genetic standpoint and from an environmental standpoint, that child should love sports as much as their father does. So in any case, there's probably something going on, you know, have it checked out.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, tell us one of two of your favorite success stories that you've seen.
You know, there's so many of them that we have here.
I hear it's a very rewarding field that you're in because you actually see a lot of success stories with your patients.
We do. You know, every day we come in and it's different. It's not a category like I'm dealing with this eye teaming problem. It's a person, and each person is different. You know, a lot of those differences are based on their genetics and their environment and their experiences that they're having. You know, we're having some cases right now where we're working with a lot of people who've had brain injuries, whether it's sports related or, you know, automobile related or war. You know, we have a lot of concussive, you know, blast issues. And those have been very, very rewarding for us. We had one gentleman, he served several times in tour of duty, and his best friend had just committed suicide, and he was close to committing suicide. And one of the things that happens after a brain injury is many of these people are unable to fall asleep afterwards, and simply because that part of the nervous system, there's the autonomic nervous system, and you're either in fight mode, which is the sympathetic mode, or you're in rest and restore, which is parasympathetic. So many of these with brain injuries are in fight or flight. Their brain just does not flip over into going to sleep. And so we'll see some of these individuals, it's been 10 years since they've been able to fall asleep. And we can use phototherapy for them. And a lot of times by day two, they're reporting their first complete restful night of sleep.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is. And so some of these individuals that family may not realize how close they were to losing them to suicide, you know, they report to us afterwards that they're feeling a lot better, that this has saved their life. You know, I've watched with children. We'll have a lot of children. We're seeing the football-related injuries. And I've gotten to the point, I used to enjoy watching football. I do not now because I sit there and I'll watch a play and I think, brain injury.
Yeah.
Brain injury. And it just saddens me because I know these young children and young adults are having problems that unless they're dealt with, that it's going to affect them the rest of their life. And so dealing with that, treating them and helping them to restore, you know, and regain their functions has been enjoyable. Just the child who we had one this week in Mississippi, a little girl brought all these rewards that she brought in that she'd made at the end of the school. And she laid them all out on the table, and she said, I was able to do all these because my vision is getting better. And that's
why
she's a therapist.
Yeah, and you've also seen personality changes. I mean, haven't you seen them kind of come out of their shell and go from an introvert to an extrovert?
Yeah, your daughter was one of those. I still remember your daughter, you know, was very, very much introverted when she started. And then she pulled a prank on our staff one day.
Yeah.
And what did she have, a gym suit on and a wig?
She had a wig and, yeah, pretended to be somebody else. Yeah, we had a big time after out of that.
I didn't recognize her. I mean, she had changed so much from going from, you know, initially to being able to have a sense of humor and pull pranks on them. But no, we see changes like that, and it's just very rewarding.
Yeah, well, what happened, really, her true personality started coming out because she's a prankster and a jokester, loves to make people laugh. But she wasn't like that when we first started going to you guys.
No, she was not a happy girl when she started.
Yeah, no, she wasn't. And so, okay. Well, so how do people contact you for more information or if they want to, you know, check out maybe getting an appointment or talk with you guys?
Okay. Well, the name of our practice is Snyder Therapy Centers. We are located, we have three offices right now and about to open our fourth one. I don't know if you knew that one.
I didn't know that.
But we're located, home office is in Birmingham, Alabama, and our first satellite office was Columbus, Mississippi. We've got another satellite office in Huntsville, Alabama, and next month we're opening our third satellite, and it will be in Dothan, Alabama. So we're excited about that.
Well, that's great. That's great.
So they can look up on the website and have these contact numbers and just contact us, and we'd be glad to work with them. Also, we're going to be talking at the homeschooling conference in June, the CHEF conference. We're one of the featured workshop speakers this year, so we're very happy about that invitation.
Okay, and where is that going to be?
That is going to be here in Birmingham at the Metro Church of God. But if they look at the name of the organization is CHEF, C-H-E-F, stands for Christian Homeschool Education Fellowship, I believe. But they can look that up and get all the details on how to register for that conference.
Okay. Well, we'll put that in the article below in the information below the podcast when it gets posted online.
Okay.
But now, let's see, when did you say that was going to be? Is it this weekend?
No, the homeschool one, I think, is about the, I think it's the last weekend in June.
Okay, okay. We'll put that in the article below the podcast. Okay, and you can go to SnyderTherapyCenters.com. We'll also put that below the podcast mm-hmm. on the website, and they can go there to get the numbers and find out more information.
Right.
Okay, is there anything else you would like to say before we end?
Well, no, I just appreciate the opportunity that you've allowed me to get this work out. I mean, we can, this is something that you and I could probably discuss for the rest of the week.
Eight hours. yeah, this is so interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, what you're doing.
Yeah, well, and thank you for taking the time. I know you're very busy, and I know this is such. I've been wanting to do this for a while, and really excited about getting this information out. And thank you for listening. This is Beverly Butler with the America Out Loud Network, and you've been listening to the Misdiagnosed Life podcast. Be sure to subscribe to iTunes and rate and review the show. And as always, take care until next time.